From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Following the mass shooting at an historically African-American church last month in Charleston, South Carolina, a heated national debate has ensued over the meaning and placement of the Confederate battle flag. We're taking your calls to find out what the flag means to Southwest Floridians as we get context and insight from a renowned flag expert. Plus, World Hepatitis Day is coming up later this month. Experts say 5 million Americans could be living with chronic viral hepatitis and that many of them don't even know they're infected. We explore risk factors, screening guidelines, and treatment options for hepatitis, along with the state health department's efforts to prevent and track the spread of infections. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. For the remainder of the hour, we'll be taking a closer look at hepatitis ahead of World Hepatitis Day coming up July 28th. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, about 2.7 million people in the U.S. are living with chronic hepatitis C. Between 2012 and 2013, the number of reported acute cases of hepatitis C increased from just over 1,700 to more than 2,100. About 15,000 Americans die each year from liver ailments related to viral hepatitis. More than 5 million Americans could be living with chronic viral hepatitis, yet health experts say the vast majority of them don't even know they're infected. The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force recommends that all adults from the baby boomer generation get tested at least once in their lifetime. Joining me now for a closer look at best practices on screening and treatment and public health efforts to track the spread of hepatitis is Dr. Manuel Revuelta with Infectious Disease Specialist Lee Physicians Group here in Fort Myers. That's with Lee Memorial Health System. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you.
We're also speaking with Dr. Anna Lykos. She's a state epidemiologist and director of the Florida Department of Health's Division of Disease Control and Health Protection. Dr. Lykos, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
And I invite listeners to join our conversation as well. Connect with our guests with a phone call to 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Post comments or questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media, or follow the live Twitter feed using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And first of all, Dr. Revuelta, let's get a clear definition of what we mean when we talk about hepatitis. My introduction focused kind of heavily on hepatitis C, but it's really a broad term encompassing a group of different viruses, correct?
Yes, and not just viruses. There are primary hepatitis viruses, which are A, B, C. There's a hepatitis delta, which is something that is a defective virus that piggybacks on top of people who have chronic hepatitis B. There is hepatitis E, and there are probably others that are primary hepatitis viruses that haven't been well delineated yet. However, there's also other diseases that cause hepatitis, and some of them are autoimmune. There are other infections that cause hepatitis. Hepatitis, as a term itself, just means inflammation of the liver. So among the other things, not just autoimmune, but probably one of the most common, if not common, causes of hepatitis or liver inflammation is fatty liver disease from morbid obesity or diabetes.
Okay. And I understand hepatitis can also be caused by exposure to toxic substances?
Yes, it can. Yeah, drug-induced hepatitis certainly is well-known. There are many drugs, some of them are antibiotics, which we know can cause inflammation of the liver.
And from a public health perspective, you know, what types of hepatitis are we primarily concerned with?
I think from a public health perspective, oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah, please, Dr. Lykos.
This is for me, then?
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry about that.
Actually, we began reporting the hepatitides in 1999. Both hepatitis A and B were reportable at that time, as well as hepatitis C became reportable in July of 1999. So we've been collecting data on them for several years.
All right. And, you know, in the summer of 2013, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force advised that all baby boomers should get tested for hepatitis C. And the Centers for Disease Control made a similar recommendation targeting boomers. What's behind that recommendation? What were the recommendations like before? And why do we, you know, see this focus on folks from that one generation?
Well, the recommendation to start testing baby boomers actually came from looking at the data from a national perspective that CDC had collected over several years. And we typically take our data, divide it into age groups, and they noted that people who had been born between 1945 and 1965, the so-called baby boomers, they had a 2.6% risk of having hepatitis C infection, and this was six times higher than any other age group. Thus, the recommendation to test baby boomers was made at that time by both the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force and the CDC. The thinking behind it is we need to realize that hepatitis C was actually first discovered or identified as a distinct agent in 1989. The baby boomers are, as I mentioned, born between 1945 and 1965. And being one myself, I remember a lot of different activities that we used to do. And several people got tattoos and participated in other activities that have since become regulated. So it's entirely possible that through needle uses, tattoos, or sharing diabetic equipment that used to be rather common in certain circumstances, as well as any kind of the drugs that were used at that time may have resulted in higher rates in that specific population.
Okay. And, you know, from the numbers I mentioned earlier, it is kind of alarming the number of folks who are potentially out there who could have hepatitis and just not even know it. Dr. Revuelta, how is it that this can remain dormant in somebody's body while they remain asymptomatic? And can it be causing harm even if you don't show signs of it and just don't even know?
Yeah, certainly hepatitis C causes damage even when people are asymptomatic. And to a variable degree, and people are different. There are different genotypes, different subtypes of hepatitis C. And some create more inflammatory activity than others. But with hepatitis C, the difference between hepatitis A and B in terms of the medical presentation of the disease, more people with acute hepatitis A will present with severe symptoms, for example, jaundice and pain and nausea and vomiting. And with hepatitis B, it's also similarly so, although there are many people who had subclinical hepatitis B, which they were exposed and they're now immune, that don't develop it. The difference between the three clinically is A, does not become chronic. You usually develop a severe hepatitis, and it's a pretty miserable illness, and then it goes away after several weeks and you're well. Although I have in one case seen a case where the person was sick for almost 3 months, it tends to be a more self-limited process. With hepatitis B, it's different than A in that a certain percentage of patients will develop chronic hepatitis from hepatitis B. And what happens with the chronic hepatitis of hepatitis B is a certain subset of patients will become chronic carriers that don't develop a lot of inflammation, but then there are chronic active and chronic persistent hepatitis patients who will go on to develop cirrhosis. And a lot of that is because of the immune response to the virus itself. It is the immune response trying to clear the virus and not able to do it, which causes fibrosis and eventually cirrhosis, and in a smaller number of people can cause liver cancer. With hepatitis C, it's quite a different virus. It's a flavivirus, which means it's related to dengue and other tropical diseases and some diseases of animals. And usually two-thirds, 67 to 70% of people will develop some form of chronic hepatitis from hepatitis C. That's much, much higher than with hep B. And then the other third will go on to clear it. But in the ones that develop chronic hepatitis C, you know, you get up to 24% of people developing cirrhosis, and a certain number of those will go on to develop hepatocellular cancer. So the differences are many. With hepatitis C, it doesn't necessarily mean the immune response is responsible for the inflammation and the necrosis of cells in the liver. It's in some ways a metabolic virus. It tends to also cause fatty liver or fatty liver inflammation in a certain number of patients. And there are other things about hepatitis C. For example, there are medications. I mean, I've certainly seen many hepatitis C and HIV co-infected patients. There were certain medications that you use to treat HIV that can accelerate the progression of hepatitis C disease. And the co-infection itself leads to more inflammation and rapid progression towards cirrhosis. Drinking alcohol is very bad. There's dietary changes that can also be very bad and drive a lot of people with hepatitis C co-infection, not only to develop fatty liver, but in many instances, type 2 diabetes. So the type of illnesses are very, very different between all three of those viruses.
Okay. And is hepatitis screening considered a standard part of primary care these days? Do health insurance providers typically cover that kind of screening, Dr. Rivalta?
As far as I know, they do. I certainly routinely screen my patients. I do mostly, probably 90% infectious diseases as a practice, but I do some primary care, and I've always screened my patients for hepatitis A, B, and C. A and B in particular because we have vaccines that can prevent them if you've never had them. And C because it's important to know whether you have it or not, and so you could follow other guidelines. And now with the advent of the new drugs, it's going to be easier to not only screen people because they know there are better treatments, but to treat them and cure them so that they don't end up developing any of the chronic problems associated with chronic hepatitis C infection.
Is that something that we see a lot of in terms of drug development, things that, you know, could be more tolerable as a drug treatment on patients or drugs that can treat more than one genotype?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've treated hep C for 20 years, practiced in New York for 14 of those years, and definitely had a lot of HIV, hepatitis C co-infection, and it was very difficult, for example, when you were on HIV medications to tolerate the mixture of the hepatitis C drugs that were available before, which included injectable interferons, which caused a lot of depression and all sorts of other problems, and then the ribavirin, which frequently made people anemic. So the new drugs are completely different, and also we used to have pretty good success with hepatitis C genotypes 2 and 3. With the new agents, we really can treat most of the patients that we have in the U.S. who happen to have hepatitis genotype 1A or 1B.
Ahead of World Hepatitis Day on July 28th, we're talking with Fort Myers infectious disease specialist Dr. Manuel Rivalta, along with Dr. Anna Lykos with the Florida Department of Health, about symptoms, risk factors, and treatments associated with hepatitis. You can join our conversation with your comments and questions. Studio lines are open at 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or follow the live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And Dr. Lykos, tell us about the State Health Department's Enhanced Surveillance Project for Hepatitis. I understand that's been going on since 2011. Exactly what is that, and why is it important to take a statewide approach when it comes to tracking hepatitis?
Yeah, I'm happy to tell you about that. First, let me put the surveillance just into a little perspective as well. As I mentioned, it began in 1999, and that was a paper-based system, meaning that physicians had to mail reports of hepatitis C to us or send it by fax or some other kind of snail mail kind of approach to reporting. In 2002, we actually began our first enhancement to the system when we began using electronic laboratory reporting, and this was from the four public health laboratories that belong to the Department of Health. since that time, we have increased that number to where today we have over 197 laboratories and 65 hospitals reporting results of hepatitis C screening to us electronically. So that has resulted in a tremendous increase in the number of reports. And in the past 4 to 5 years, we've really maximized on our ability to analyze that data and see what's going on, such that in 2014, we had over 22,000 cases of hepatitis C reported, and 80% of those were by electronic reporting. The second enhancement that we have made is actually in terms of storing the results of tests. We're now able to get negative tests so that we can see when a person goes from having a negative screening test to a positive screening test if they are tested twice within a 6 month period of time. And that's a flag to us. It says this is a case of acute hepatitis C infection. In addition, we can store multiple tests in our surveillance system, and we can now also store liver function tests, which just gives us a lot more information. Using all of that information and looking at our data and talking with our national experts at the CDC, it was noted nationally that there was a second increase. I talked already about an increase in the number of cases in the baby boomers. Mm-hmm. Well, starting about 2010 or so, we started to see an increase in the 18 to 30-year-old age range. This is not expected either nationally, and we did see a similar peak here in Florida. So now we've begun our fourth enhancement to the surveillance system, which is to really look more closely at those 18 to 30-year-olds in terms of risk factors and exactly what kind of hepatitis they might be having. As a result of that, we're now diagnosing, actually finding more acute hepatitis cases. We went from 100 per year reported in 2011, and 2014 we had 184 reported. So we're finding those through this enhanced surveillance. And as well, we're getting a lot more information on risk factors and what activities are the 18 to 30-year-olds doing that might be increasing their risk of hepatitis.
Any hypotheses at this point about what might be causing that increase in the younger age demographic?
Well, we're still very much in the early stages of really scrutinizing the data very well. But the initial sway is it looks like it's an increase in injection drug use. That's about all we really know at this time. We're trying to get more detail about specific drugs and practices and groups, all the different kinds of ways that we look at a disease in a population to give us more specific information.
And, besides the age demographic trend that you've identified here that we've been talking about, are there other kinds of demographic trends, say perhaps geographical? Do you notice there are certain parts of the state where rates of hepatitis infection are considerably higher than others?
This is typically we're going to find the higher rates in areas of greater population density.
Right.
So, yeah, we do see it more with our larger metropolitan cities and areas with increased movement of populations in and out of that area as well. So some of our larger cities, Miami, Tampa, those kinds of places are where we do find a greater number of hepatitis C cases. However, that's really a function of just the population density.
Gotcha. And let's talk about the State Department of Health's Hepatitis Prevention Program. What's involved in that public outreach effort?
Well, we have a number of activities. First of all, the key to preventing any kind of infectious disease is really rapid identification and education to help the person who is infected to help them prevent the transmission of the virus to an uninfected individual. Education in prevention techniques as well as characteristics of the disease is always very important to us. We are having the World Health Day event around the state. Collier County is actually, I believe, in your listening area.
Yes.
And they're planning on offering free testing for hepatitis, HIV, and other STDs on both 722 and 723. We also have events going on in the Miami-Dade area as well as the Pinellas area, if any of your listeners aren't traveling to those areas as well. We also have support groups. We have at least six in Bay County, just added a seventh support group where people can come together and share their experiences and give each other support once they've been identified as having hepatitis C. We, at these events, also offer vaccination for hepatitis A and B, which is an important function. We've noted in public health, we've seen the rates of hepatitis B especially just plummet to almost nothing with the advent of vaccination in our children. I think I'll stop there.
Okay. And, well, I do like that you mentioned the testing events coinciding with World Hepatitis Day in Collier County. We'll definitely be in touch with health department offices throughout our listening area and post information about those events on our website as well. And that is unfortunately all the time we have for today's show. But thanks so much to my guests, Dr. Manuel Revelta and Dr. Anna Lykos, for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Manuel Revelta is an infectious disease specialist with Lee Memorial Health System. Anna Lykos is a state epidemiologist and director of the Florida Department of Health's Division of Disease Control and Health Protection. There's more information on the show, as well as an archive of past shows at our website, wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. To comment on anything you've heard on this or any edition of the program, send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Thanks to my producers Luke Martin and Richard Chinqui. This is WGCU, Fort Myers, Naples, Sarasota, 90.1 FM, WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.